things to exercise your mind based on what we've learned.
Some of the Dishon talks about these things.
It says on the bottom, the Elisha one, for candlelighting and figures. It says on the label.
That's right.
Started at the Turaway, Northwest London, Thursday, 9th December, 5th of Teves, Rabbi Dr. Samuel Landau, Goats and Coats, Yehuda's Finest Hour. This week's Torah has been sponsored by Vaidichka Lichvod Simchas Nisun of Mordechai Rand and Mindy Roth, Yerotzen Shivnu Bias Nemon Be Israel Hashem Ulsev Hillel.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here on Torah Way for the first time, so thank you very much for having me. This week's parasha begins by Yigash Elam. Yehuda approaches the viceroy of Egypt and decides to stand up for his youngest brother Binyamin. Something has changed in this man, because just two parashios ago, here in Yehuda, we had the mastermind behind the taking away of his brother Yosef, the person who orchestrated what would then lead his father Yaakov into an intense depression that could not be lifted. We had the person, essentially, in Yehuda, who was willing to rip apart his home and his family. And in a mere two parashiyos later, we now have someone who is willing to stand up to the prince of Egypt, to the king of Egypt, in order to try and bring his family back together. What has changed in Yehuda that allowed him to transport himself, to change himself, from what we saw two parashiyos ago to this week's Torah portion, Parashas Vayigash? So I think a clue lies in a very strange perek within the Yosef story. The Yosef saga takes up a very large piece of Sefer Bereishis, but it has a pause in the middle of it, Perek Lamed Ches, which seems to have very little to do with the rest of the story. That's the story of Yehuda and Tamar. That there we have a break just after the sale of Yosef, after Mechiras Yosef, there is this break to take us into some other story of Yehuda. It's a rather tricky story, it's a racy story. Perek Lamed Ches, what's it doing over there? We don't hear anything about the other Shvatim, what else they're doing whilst all this is happening. We don't hear about the secret life of Dan and Gad and Asher, but we do hear about the private life of Yehuda. And it's not just us that's bothered by this question, Rashi is bothered by this question. And Rashi says, Laman is Mechal Parashah Zulekan. Why is there a juxtaposition between the story of Yosef and over here? Why is the parasha over here of Yehuda and Tamar? The hivstik b'parashoso shel Yosef, to make a break in the story of Yosef. And I think, by the way, if we answer this question that Rashi is asking us, that we have when we read this section, we'll be able to see what has changed in Yehuda, the transformation that he has made to enable him to stand up in front of what he doesn't know is his brother Yosef, what he thinks is the viceroy of Egypt, and is able to try and save his whole family and save this story. So what does Rashi say? The It comes to teach us that his brothers caused him to come down from his greatness when they saw the pain of their father. Amru, they said to Yehuda, Ata amar to the machro, you said we should sell him. Ilu amar to the hashivoi hayinu shomim lecho. If you told us to return him to Dad, we'd have listened to you as well. You had influence over us as the brothers. You could have tipped the situation of Mechiras Yosef one way or the other. Either we would have thrown him into the pit, we would have murdered him, or we'd have taken him home. But we would have listened to you, and now you're the one that's caused father's grief. What's the problem with this Rashi? A number of problems with this Rashi. The first problem is, they didn't think their father was going to be sad when they framed the death, the bloody murder, or this accident with his beloved son. They didn't think their father was going to be sad. They're blaming Yehuda. You're the one that made our father grieve. As if the grief was something unexpected. a shul, so I have to go into many sad situations. One of the saddest situations as the Rav of a shul is to be present at the Levaya when a parent buries a child. Whether that's an adult parent, a younger parent burying a younger child, an adult parent burying an adult child, I will always say a parent should never have to bury a child. They didn't think their father was going to be sad. Why are they blaming Yehuda? This was all part of the plan, wasn't it? But the answer comes in the end of Perek Lamed Zayin, in the end of the Perek that just precedes this one. Something strange happens with this grief. The Torah records that Vayakumu, Kol Banav v'Chobnos of Lanachamoy, all Yaakov's sons, they get up. His daughters, they get up to try and comfort him, to give him Nichum Aveilim, by Martin his Nachim. But he will not be comforted. It's interesting that word, Vayimayin, features at a number of high points in the Yosef story. It also features in last week's parasha when Potiphar's wife, that's right, with the Shalshelas, with the very dramatic Vayimayin, that just as somehow Yaakov holds Yosef in mind by with refusing to be consoled, so too Yosef holds Yaakov in mind by refusing to give in to Potiphar's wife. Maybe that's what they saw in the famous Medrash, that he saw Dmus, he saw the appearance of his father. There was some almost psychic connection between father and son. Father wouldn't give up on son, and son would not give up on father's values either, despite being accosted by Potiphar's wife. Why is he withholding from being consoled? So Rashi explains, Ein adam bekabel tanchumen al achai v'savar shemeis. A person will never be consoled on a living person who we suspect they've passed away. She'alameis nigzer gzera she'ishtak min alei v'lo al achai. For a living person, there's the capacity to forget. So for a dead person, there's a capacity to forget. For a living person, you can't give up hope. In my primary school, they used to teach us about the serviceman in the Israeli Defense Forces, Ron Arad, who was taken capture in Lebanese territory before I was even born, in 1986, and they didn't know what would happen to him. And for years and years and years, there was this campaign, try and find out, even just to get the body, that his widow, well, is she a widow or not? That his wife, well, is she his wife or not? That his family should have closure on Ron Arad. All Yaakov has is a bloody coat. All he has is a coat dipped in blood. He hasn't seen a body. Ein adam mekabel tanchumin al achai v'savar shemeis. He can't receive tanchumin. He can't be consoled because he doesn't know if his son is alive or dead. All he has is this nagging suspicion. Some evidence, a coat which is dipped in blood, but he doesn't know. And this is what the brothers say. This is what they say to Yehuda. Yes, we knew father was going to be sad, but most people, they go through a grieving process. Kubler-Ross, five stages of grief. They go through a grieving process, but then they incorporate that grief into their life. People can not get over grief, but necessarily they can integrate grief into their daily life and get on with their life. Yaakov is unable to integrate that grief. He loses Nevuah. He says he's going to go down to Sheol. He's going to go down to hell. In the diagnostic and statistical, the DSM manual, the psychiatric manual of disorders. So the first 6 months following a bereavement, you're not allowed to diagnose clinical depression, because grief and clinical depression look very similar. It's only after 6 months, if there's an extended, complicated grief reaction, that then you could diagnose clinical depression. Yaakov goes into a depression. He's unable to lift himself out. The Shekhinah leaves him, and it only comes back when he's reunited with Yosef. That's what the brothers say to Yehuda. And that's why, it wasn't that time in Perek Lamed Ches. Yehuda is brought down from his brothers, because they didn't think this was going to end like this. They thought they would be able to be menachem their father, and they weren't able to. Okay, so that answers why the first pasuk is there. The first pasuk of Perek Lamed Ches we understand. Okay, there was a situation. Yehuda was the mastermind of this plan, and now, as a result of that plan, the brothers have taken him away from his gedula. What about the rest of the story? Why is the rest of the story there? So I want to share with you a theory. It's not my theory. It's a theory from Rabbi David Foreman of alephbeta.org. I really love his parasha material. And so he says that maybe Yehuda has to face what he caused his father Yaakov to face. Maybe there is some challenge that Yehuda caused his father to experience, and now he's going to have to redeem by experiencing it as well, and maybe changing the situation. And there seems to be a pattern throughout Sefer Bereishis of repeating challenges. And they're either repeated by the next protagonists, or they're redeemed. They're changed by doing something different. And so here I'd like to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a core story, and then I'm going to tell you two different versions of the story. One in the world of Yaakov and Yosef, and one in the world of Yehuda and Tamar. And maybe just a stand back from this story is to say, let's imagine that we want to learn Parsha together, and we decide we're going to learn a really early Rishon, or a really early commentary on the Torah. So we say, no, I don't want to do Rashi, I don't want to do Ramban, I don't do any Rishonim, I want to go even earlier, maybe like Sforno, maybe even earlier, maybe we'll just learn Medrash. Imagine if you could say, we'll learn the earliest commentator on the Torah itself. We'll learn the earliest commentator on the Torah. What's the earliest commentator on the Torah? It's the Torah itself, the text itself comments on itself. God comments on his own book. You'd say, oh, it would be a bit funny. But let's imagine that Hashem puts into the Torah textual clues that allow the text itself to lift, to comment on itself. One of the tools that I think HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses in his Torah to give its own commentary on itself, we could use a fancy name called intertextuality. We could use another name, which is, when have we seen this before? Essentially, where the same word appears, or the same themes appear in two different locations, in two different contexts, but it's the same language, and it's the same theme, and they're resonating, they're causing two parts of the Torah to resonate with each other, like a tuning fork. It's got two arms, the two arms vibrate, and they talk to each other, and they create music. So do the Torah. One of the tools I think the Torah uses is it uses this intertextuality. Two parts, two different texts, different contexts, but the same ideas and even the same language. So here's the story, the core story, which is going to resonate in two different ways in those two tracks. So once upon a time, in a story involving coats and goats, there lived people who were enduring an unending mourning for a person who was not quite dead, and a man who lost two children owing to a failure in loyalty of one son to another, who was desperately trying to hold on to his third son, even though letting go of the third son would end the cycle. Okay, that's the core story. Let's break it down into two tracks. Let's start with the Yosef and Yaakov track. Once upon a time, in a story involving coats. So Yaakov gave Yosef the special coat. And when Yosef's brothers sold him, they took the coat, dipped it in blood, and gave it to Yaakov to identify, using the words, Haker Na. So once upon a time in a story involving coats and goats, because what did the brothers dip the coat into? They dipped it into the blood of a goat. There lived people who were enduring an unending mourning for a person who was not quite dead. Yaakov mourned for Yosef, for whom there was no body or burial, leaving a crippling suspicion always lurking in his heart. And a man who lost two children. Well, Yaakov lost Yosef when he was sold, and then he lost Shimon in last week's parasha, when his son Yosef, who we don't know is Yosef, the masked Egyptian stranger, takes Shimon and puts him into prison, waiting for Binyamin to come down. Why has this happened? There's a failure in loyalty of one son to another. This all could have been avoided if something else had happened. Because at the time of Mechiras Yosef, Reuben has a different plan. Reuben tries to stand in the breach against the rest of the brothers. Now, Reuben was the firstborn. Who needs to back up the firstborn in order to make this plan continue? It's the secondborn. Who's the secondborn? Shimon. Shimon, as the second oldest brother, could have supported the oldest brother, Reuben, who tried to protect Yosef from the anger of the other brothers. And this person who was enduring this morning was desperately trying to hold on to his third son. Yaakov would not let Binyamin go down to Mitzrayim, lest he lose another son. Even though, if Binyamin were to go down to Mitzrayim, not only would Yaakov get back Shimon, he would also get back Yosef, because then Yosef would reveal himself and the whole family would be reunited. And that's the deadlock that we have in the Yaakov and Yosef track. That because Yaakov is unwilling to let go of Binyamin, he's unwilling to continue in this story, there is this deadlock. That's story number one. I'll tell you story number two. In the Yehuda and Tamar track, once upon a time in a story involving coats. Well, Yehuda gave his coat as an eravon, as a collateral payment to Tamar for services rendered. This coat was later given to Yehuda to identify when Tamar was being taken out to be burnt after Yehuda thought that she had been mezane with somebody else. And what was the language that Tamar used? The same language. Hakerna. By the way, if you do a search of the Torah, there's only two places in the whole Torah that there's the language Hakerna. It's these two places. Also, that language of Hakara is very interesting because when it talks about Yosef and his brothers interacting with each other, Vayakiru, he recognized them, they didn't recognize him. The same language of Hakara, but that language of Hakerna, only in these two places in the whole Torah, when Yaakov is being given the coat to recognize, and when Yehuda is being given his own coat to recognize. There's also coats, goats, in the story involving coats and goats. What a goat was Tamar's actual fee for her services rendered, for which she received in place of that, Yehuda's staff, his signet ring, and his coat. By the way, what are those three things? A staff, a signet ring, and a coat. What do those represent for Yehuda? It's Malchus. He's given up his Malchus. And what happens at the end of the story? He'll get them back. Okay, so there lived a person who was enduring an unending mourning for a person who was not quite dead. Who's the person who's mourning in the Yehuda and Tamar story? Well, Tamar is mourning. Tamar is mourning for her husband, Er. It's actually Rav backwards, who was not fully dead, because Er could live on via Yibum through Onan, literally mourning. Yehuda named the one child wickedness backwards, another child mourning. And Onan could have done Yibum. And Yibum and Er doesn't, Onan doesn't do that. They both don't cause Tamar to have a child. And so now, there's still the possibility of a further Yibum with Yehuda's third son, Shelah. If there's a final Yibum, then Onan could come back. Er could come back through Yibum, through Tamar. And this man, and there's a man who's lost two children, Yehuda's lost Er and Onan following their relationships with Tamar, owing to a failure in loyalty of one son to another. Why did this happen? If Onan had only performed Yibum properly, then Er would live on through Onan, through their child and Tamar, and this wouldn't have had to have happened. And Yehuda is desperately trying to hold on to his third son, Shelah. He doesn't want her to marry Tamar, lest the same thing happen to him. Even though this would end the cycle, because if Shelah would marry Tamar, then the children would come back, his sons would come back, and his legacy would live on. So, what's the story? The story is once upon a time, in a story involving coats and goats, there lived people who were enduring an unending mourning for a person who was not quite dead, and a man who lost two children, owing to a failing loyalty of one brother, of one son to another, who's desperately trying to hold on to his third son, even though this would end the cycle.
Where's the coat in Thomas' story?
The coat in the Tamar story. Yehuda gave his coat as an eravon, as a collateral. He gave his tunic.
No, it's a
shirt.
Was
that
a coat as well?
Yeah,
of course.
Shirt.
Was
that
a coat?
Coat.
To remember.
So where's the tunic?
Yeah.
To remember the coat in that story. Could be it's there.
Okay. It's not the same language of Kusainis, but it's still he gives his garment. He doesn't give his garment.
Okay. It was Yosef who left his garment behind.
Okay, we'll come back to it. So, What is going on over here? Why is the theme repeating itself in the Yehuda and Tamar story as well as the Yaakov and Yosef story? It's because there is an opportunity here for Yehuda to do something different. In both stories, a masked stranger takes action. A hidden stranger takes action. Tamar covers herself up, disguises herself, and takes action on the road. In the Yehuda In the Yosef and Yaakov story, also a masked stranger, so to speak, takes action. They don't recognize Yosef because he's got his beard, he looks very different, he's in a different costume now, and he also takes action. But the action that Yehuda takes in last week's parasha is to recognize that not only did he have to stand up and say Tzad Kamimeni in his own life, she is more righteous than me. Not only did he have to be Yehuda, not just in name, but also in action. Yehuda, lahodos, to not only to thank, but also to admit, to stand up for what is right, to take responsibility, which is ultimately what leadership is about. It's about holding integrity in what we do. Radically telling the truth, even at personal shame, because it's the right thing to do. He recognized that that is a tool. Silefa, thank you. He recognized that that is the tool. Thank you very much. He recognizes that is the tool for also standing up to his father. It's a very interesting language. In last week's parasha, where they convince Yaakov to give over Binyamin to go down. First of all, Reuben says, it's all right, I'll take responsibility. If I don't come back, you can even kill my children. Yaakov doesn't seem to listen to that. But then Yehuda stands up. And he says to his father, here's a man who had lost two children and was holding another and was in a stuck situation, who was able to unpick his situation. How was he able to unpick his situation? Through the Eravoy. Through the collateral payment that Tamar gave, the Eravoy was the tool to unlock the situation, because he recognized that that was his cloak and that was his staff and that was his signet ring. So too he says, I will also give up myself as an Eravoy. The same language. I'll give myself as a collateral payment. I recognize the situation you are in. Man speaks to man. Son speaks to father. I will give an Eravoy and I will break your deadlock. And then we move into this week's parasha. And Yehuda finally not only mends his own breakdown of integrity two parashiyos ago. He not only mends how he can relate to his father through that, using an Eravoy, he also mends the split amongst the brothers. What happened in the story there? Yehuda says something in Parashas Vayigash, in this speech that he makes that we read this morning, that drastically turns the tide. It seems to be a relatively pedestrian speech. My father is an old man, he's in Eretz Yisrael, and our Eretz Canaan. He had two sons, he really loved them, one's gone, this is the only one that's left. Come on, you have to give him over. Now, we know the subtext, but if Yehuda is speaking to the viceroy of Egypt, what does this little pedestrian story about their family politics have to do? Why is that going to move this? What is going on here? What is he saying? And why does it also move Yosef finally to back down from this superior position that he's taking and to then reach out?
He knew the background history, what led up to it.
But I think there's more as well, because, well, let me work it through. We're going to look at it from the brother's perspective here. When they go back to their father and they ask for Binyamin, the father says some very painful language. He says, Binyamin's my only child left. In Perek Membeis, Pasuk Lamaches. He says, Lo Yere Bini Machem, my son is not going with you. Ki Achiv Meis, his brother died, the Hulavada Nisha, he alone is left over. If you're the rest of the brothers, how does that land for you? It's pretty painful. Because this whole thing started because Yaakov favored Yosef. This suspicion that got into under the skin of the brothers was that maybe dad loves this one more than us. And that suspicion is now being explicitly confirmed as Yaakov is continuing to speak about Binyamin in this way. It must be a painful reminder of how this whole painful situation started and was perpetuated. Not only that, but if you think about it, Yaakov is willing to let Shimon rot in an Egyptian prison rather than let go of Binyamin. He's willing to let the family starve rather than let go of Binyamin. Now, we're not commenting right now on the appropriateness of favoritism. We're just noticing something here. So then what happens? Finally, they convince Father to take Binyamin down. Yehuda stands up, says, I will be the Eir Avoyim. They go down to Egypt, and then something terrible happens. There's the Gviot, there's the coast, there's the cup in Binyamin's pack. And all of a sudden, we have a replay of the same situation. All of a sudden, Binyamin is being told that he is going to be taken as a slave down into Egypt, just as Yosef was taken once before as a slave down into Egypt. The whole thing is replaying itself again. And yet, something else happens. Yehuda is not only willing to face up to the truth of his own lack of integrity, he's not only willing to face up and stand up for what is right, even if it's at personal risk, he's also able to face the sad family situation that began the whole thing. He's able to say, you know what, my father is my father. He is who he is. And he loves two sons more than everybody else. And I have to respect that man's love, even if it's a personal cost. Even if it breaks me to be a less favorite child. That's what he's saying in this speech at the beginning of Parashas Vayigash. He's not only being moideh to his own space, his own actions, but he's also holding integrity for the man, for the father that he's putting before himself. I will go as a slave instead of Binyamin. I will put myself in his place. Because I respect my father's wishes enough, even if they're painful, to do that. For me, Yehuda has turned the whole situation around. He started off as the architect of the Mechiras Yosef. He started off as the architect that ripped the family apart, that took away his father's prophecy, that caused this long, long experience of sadness, of pain. Then in his own life he was challenged. Can you, in this goats and coats story, this goats and coats story that has echoes even further back of another goats and coats story in Sefer Bereishis. Back at the time of Yaakov and Esav, there's a goat which is the meal, there's a coat which he has to wear, there's a treachery of one brother against another. There's something which is filtered down into this story as well. There's the goats and coats of Yaakov and Yosef, there's the goats and coats of Yehuda and Tamar. And there, Yehuda is able to do something different, to redeem that moment. And using the Eir Avoyim, stand up to his father and take on the responsibility of going down to Mitzrayim. There's then a replay of Mechiras Yosef, and Yehuda does the opposite. Rather than selling his brother out, he puts himself on the line as a slave instead. This is truly where he gets his Malchus returns, an earned Malchus, a leadership of integrity, a leadership of Hodiah. Thank you very much.
What's the word?
A word of...